Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet at WFPR.FM and on the local Franklin area dial at 102.9 on the FM band. Here today with a special session with our state representative, Jeff Roy. Jeff, happy Tuesday morning.
Happy Tuesday. Happy Tuesday before Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving. It's a great week and happy to be here to chat about some of the things that have been going on and bring folks up to speed.
Yeah, I think given some of the schedules and clearly your schedule, I'm sure you still have some stuff on it, but it's because it's Thanksgiving week. Some of the meetings may be a little bit, you know, lesser in volume and quantity, and thereby we can take, oh, so what has happened and give you a chance to, in case we missed something, what do we need to be aware of that you've been working on? As well as, yes, it's the week of Thanksgiving. Granted, life is a challenge, presents challenges all the time, but we do have so much to be thankful for. So let's take that moment or two and give thanks.
Absolutely. I know it's good to get together with our families. I know my son is in town from New York, and my other son and other daughter will be down for Thanksgiving along with the extended family. So Thursday is shaping up to be a nice day yet again, and looking forward to it, as I'm sure everybody out there is feeling the same.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
My favorite holiday.
Yeah, it certainly is up there. No presents, but that's okay. You don't need presents when you got people in conversations.
To me, that's what makes it such a great holiday. You're not, there's no pressure about presence. The only people who have pressure are those who are looking forward to Black Friday, and I am not one of those.
No. I don't do well in crowds, so yeah, you won't find me near there. And with the, from the Sherlock perspective and my wife's side, we normally do, and it was one of the things that the my siblings and I decided early on to keep the other half of the family fine. And one recognition that when we were growing up, and we were certainly part of a large family, I was the oldest of six, but my father was the middle of 10. Mother was the oldest of 10. And a lot of the holidays, we would split between the two sides of the family. And that just, we didn't like going back and forth. We liked going, but we wanted to stay there, and we had to go to somebody else's place. And it was, so we made the determination as we started getting our own families going that, you know, we would do the other side on Thanksgiving Day or Christmas or whatever the holiday was. And then the Sherlocks would get together. Generally, it's been Fridays, the day after. This week, it's going to be the Saturday after. So we split the family and we extend the celebration, which is fine.
There you go.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. But in terms of the other piece that we're here for, given some highlights to the folks that in case they've missed, well, what's Jeff been doing? How has he been busy? Certainly as your chair of TUA, what, the technology, utility, and energy?
So it's telecommunications, utilities, and energy. That would be TUE for short. So when you hear me say TUE, that's what I'm referring to. And it's a huge committee, covers a lot of ground. And I would say that the utilities and energy aspect have been the most dominant over the past 9 months. I was appointed in February. And I don't know if folks recall, but 6 weeks into my tenure, we passed the roadmap bill, which set climate goals, reaching out to 2050. And that's a bill that emerged from my committee. And that was the first item I was tasked with, is to get the roadmap bill over the finish line, get it onto the governor's desk, get him to sign it. And he did sign it on March 26th of 2021. And as soon as that work was done, my attention turned to offshore wind. Because in order for us to meet our goals of net zero by 2050, we need to replace some of the current, power sources.
Right.
And I keep the ISO app. I don't know if folks are familiar with ISO, but it's the regional energy group that monitors activity for multiple states. Mm-hmm. And ISO has an app that you can put onto your phone. And I'm actually
the power grid view.
Right. So I'm going to pull it up right now because typically at least once a day, I bring it up to see what the fuel mix is at any given time. And at this very moment, 54% of our power is coming from natural gas. 26% is coming from nuclear. And 7% is coming from hydroelectricity. And at this time, only 13% is coming from renewables. And the bulk of that is solar energy. So there's a great movement to back away from fossil fuels, which includes natural gas and oil. But in order to get there, we need to replace it. So how are we going to replace 54% of natural gas? And I will suggest to you that's pretty low. It's usually hovers in the 60 to 70% range. And offshore wind is a great resource that can allow us to shift away from these fossil fuels. And so I was tasked the day after the roadmap bill by the Speaker of the House to really see what's happening in the offshore wind space and what can we do to make Massachusetts a hub for offshore wind in the United States. So right now there are some wind turbines that are located, a lot of them out in the Midwest. We do see a couple around. I think the nuns at Mount St. Abbey and the Franklin Rentham line have a windmill. But what we're talking about is large scale wind being produced 14 miles off the coast of Massachusetts. And the most remarkable thing is that area, that leasing area, 14 miles off of Martha's Vineyard, has the most robust wind in the entire contiguous United States. Mm. So it presents a tremendous opportunity for Massachusetts to become a leader in this effort. And that's what I've been working on for the past 9 months. I put together a 122-page report, single-spaced, for the Speaker of the House, show him what the state of offshore wind is in Massachusetts, what other states are doing, what other countries are doing in that space, and a series of recommendations as to what Massachusetts can do. That lease area off Martha's Vineyard is referred to as the Saudi Arabia of wind. Mm-hmm. And we know what oil did for right. Saudi Arabia. And what we're hopeful is that wind will do for Massachusetts what we needed to do to reach our goal. So that's a long-winded answer, no pun intended, on that aspect of the job. But it's really been an incredible and all-encompassing piece. And I think it was highlighted by last week's activity. I was down at Covell's Beach in Barnstable. They're breaking ground for the cabling that is going to deliver the energy from the first large commercial offshore wind project in the entire United States, which is going to be in that lease area off of Martha's Vineyard. And it's going to be 62 turbines, which will produce enough energy to power 400,000 homes. And that's a first of multiple phases for offshore wind that we're going to see developing in Massachusetts. It's our need that we do a groundbreaking like that every year and a half for the next 10 years in order to get us where we need to be to replace that 54% of natural gas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting. I had the opportunity to travel to Iceland during the summer, and their electricity is totally renewable because of their position between the North American and Eurasian plate. They have a lot of geothermal, so that's 70%, but then they also have, I think it's 30% from water power.
70% from geothermal.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
It's unreal what they do. In most cities, Reykjavik in particular, their hot water is geothermal. So there's no restriction. And it was interesting. There was one hotel that we went to. They had a sign said, please be mindful of your hot water usage. We are not part of the geothermal system. So people were so used to, you know, if the water is cheap and it's hot, and it was, people could use it as they needed to, which certainly may raise another issue, but that's further down the road for them to figure out. But the geothermal, and then just traveling the ring road, and we can spend more time on that because we want to get into your highlights. But the ring road and the variety of glaciers, volcanoes, it's the geysers. It was just an amazing place to visit. And it's actually an easier flight than going to California.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I've heard lots of great things about it. Would love to get myself up there. The closest I've come to seeing geothermal in operation was a couple weeks ago, went to visit a Cambridge K-8 school that is powered largely by geothermal, energy. And they have 200 wells dispersed among the campus of this school that heats the building, provides the hot water, and actually cools the building in the summer, using the geothermal technology in reverse. So at times you use it to heat your building, and at other times you use it to cool your building. And it was incredible, you know, but that combination of geothermal technology with rooftop solar, every rooftop on that building had solar, and they were able to power that building without any emissions whatsoever. And that's the true definition of a net zero building, which is where we're moving. So it's 2021 right now. Within 29 years, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, by statute, has to be net zero for all of its energy sources. Mm. And so that was the first building that I have seen that's a true net zero. And that's where we're moving. And, I'm excited to be in the middle of this space. It's an exciting and wonderful opportunity to see the cutting edge research that's going on out there relative to energy sources. I mean, solar has been around for quite a while, and it's finally at a competitive price. Wind came in at a competitive price for energy. So the prospects for getting to net zero are looking pretty good.
And that's not the only thing. I think last week I saw the announcement on your work. And if I recall correctly, on the Genocide Act, at this point, it still needs some action on your part because of the way the legislation goes back and forth between the House and the Senate before actually going to the governor. But it's close, very close at this point.
It should be a matter of days before it gets to the governor's desk. The Senate had passed it back in October, and then it came to the House just last week. And the House, so the Senate was unanimous, 39-0. And the House approved the bill with a 157-2 vote. And so the prospect of that bill getting to the governor's desk is great. So both houses did what we call engrossing the bill, and the next step is enactment. So it has to go back to both branches for enactment. So last week, the Senate agreed to the amendment that the House had put on the bill. So it sends it back to the House for enactment, which could take place as early as tomorrow. And then it'll go back to the Senate for enactment there, which puts it on the governor's desk. And by all indications, it's our expectation that he will sign the bill. And just so that folks understand what that bill does is it requires public schools to teach the history of genocides as part of their curriculum following the curriculum frameworks, which were most recently updated in 2018. but it's a mandatory topic for the curriculum in all of our schools. And we often hear about unfunded mandates. Well, this bill also provided a genocide education trust fund that's going to help schools and districts develop their curriculum and host training or professional development courses that will be funded in part by a legislative budget line item. It will also, all the fines for civil rights crimes are going to be collected and put into this genocide education trust fund. And also any private entities or individuals who would like to donate to that fund will have the opportunity to contribute to that trust fund. When I originally got involved in this work, it was back in 2013, and filed the first bill back then, just trying to get genocide education included in the curriculum frameworks. And we were successful. It took some time, but by 2018, the new and revised curriculum frameworks had been issued, including the topic of genocide education. But over the past couple of years, we've noticed that even though it's in the curriculum frameworks, there wasn't a requirement that districts do it. Those are voluntary frameworks. Mm-hmm. And we were seeing a rise in anti-Semitic events and, acts of hatred.
Sure.
Throughout the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, throughout the United States of America, and realized, we had to do something more. We had to strengthen it. And the other factor is, the Holocaust survivors are dying off, and there are not many left. So memories of, the horrors associated with the Holocaust and some other genocides is beginning to fall off. And when I was presented with survey results that found that 22% of American millennials had never heard of the Holocaust, and 66% of youth 18 to 34 didn't recognize the word Auschwitz, that's when we realized, we need to do more. So we filed another bill, and it became, a hot topic. I think it was in Duxbury back in March when the football team was using Auschwitz as a
play call,
a play call, and mm-hmm. Just, reached the point where, hey, we have to really do something. We talked about this bill repeatedly. We got support from the Anti-Defamation League in New England, the Jewish Community Relations Council, the Armenian National Committee, Facing History and Ourselves, the Committee for the Holodomor Genocide Awareness, the Genocide Education Project. And there were over 60 coalition members who coalesced around this particular bill and, made it happen. And I'm happy that it's soon going to be on the governor's desk and soon going to be part of every public school curriculum in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And mark me, a lot of districts are already doing this work, but it has to be done in all 351 communities. Yeah. And it can't be done in just the communities that are well off and can afford to do these things. It has to be a part of everybody's curriculum and everybody's conversation, because, as George Santayana said it so well, those mm-hmm. who, fail to remember mm-hmm. history are damned to repeat it. Yep. And, we need to reaffirm that this is a human rights issue, and that we have to teach our students and give them the knowledge they will need to recognize the warning signs and feel empowered to prevent genocides in the future. So that's what that bill is all about. Very proud to see that it finally came to fruition and is finally going to be a part of Massachusetts law. We'll be the 20th state to do this in the United States once it's signed by the governor.
Yeah, so two things there. One, certainly a recognition and appreciation for how government works. It takes time. So you started, I think you said 2013,
That was my first year in the house.
Yeah, got the curriculum changed in 2018, but it still needed to get, you know, modified. So we're almost there, but it takes time. Government by nature does move slowly, but in many cases, for a lot of reasons, primarily good to make sure it's the right way to do it going forward. And we can, I think we're with our topic conversation, we might come back to this a little bit anyway, but let me pick up on another term because terms matter. And that's one of the things that we like to do here, at least since I was an English major, your term engrossment. So to understand a little bit of the legislative process. So as opposed to having a bill and then within each chamber, making an amendment after the bill was set, and then you do amend it in that way, that's the engrossment piece?
No, engrossment is the second to last step of getting a bill to the governor. So, a bill is filed.
Okay.
Then it goes through the committee process. This particular bill went through the Education Committee.
Right.
Then it goes to... I can't even think of the name of the committee that decides where it should go next. So it's like next.
An allocation, who best should handle it.
Right.
Yeah.
So the bill was put on the orders of the day. Okay. So then it gets onto the calendar for each branch, the House and the Senate, and it has to be read three times before it can be voted on. So, the last stop before it gets to the floor is the Committee on Bills and Third Reading. Mm-hmm. And Third Reading takes a look at the bill to make sure that, it's in order, that it cites to the correct sections of the law. So this is going to add a Section 98 to the education chapter of the Massachusetts general law. So you want to make sure that 98 is available, mm-hmm. hasn't been taken by some other bills. The third reading does all those technical pieces. And then it goes to the floor for a vote. And that's called the engrossment piece or part of the process. And from engrossment, it goes to the other branch for the other branch to engross it. So in our case, the Senate engrossed it first. Then it came back to the House for engrossment. The House added some preamble language to the bill during our engrossment. So then it goes back to the Senate for them to take action on that amendment. And the Senate adopted the amendment that the House put on it. Mm-hmm. So it sends us back to the House for what's called enactment.
Okay.
And enactment, I'm hoping, is going to take place tomorrow. And then it goes back to the Senate. And once they enact it, it gets laid on the governor's desk.
Right. Yeah, because it has to. I was familiar that it was passed. It needed both signatures, approvals to get to the governor. I wasn't aware of those terms. So engrossment was like, where is that? So thank you for that. That's a little bit more in my help and understanding. And for the listeners, I'm sure they're going to, engrossment. Oh, yeah, now I know. That's that step in the process.
And another piece of that process, what engrossment does is engrossment is the one that actually gets it printed on the parchment. So there's an engrossing department in the legislature that's it's up on the fourth floor of the building where they actually have to type the bill onto a fancy parchment paper for that's the paper that we present to the governor for
the official him to sign. Yeah.
Yep.
So even in a digital age, we still have really going back many, many millennium in some cases with parchment paper. And I know there's a seal and a wax and all that in different stages too. So we're not totally digital yet.
Yeah. Well, when I have a bill that I've worked on that I've played a role in, I typically will get the parchment from the engrossing section, with all the signatures and have it framed with the pen that the governor used to sign the bill. And it's, I hang them in my office and it's, a nice reminder of what's involved. And usually I'll put pictures of the steps along the way in that same frame. So it's, it's a nice display and it's a nice reminder of the things that we've done.
Sure. And related, but more in terms of your overall, I guess it comes under the energy piece, the recycling event that was held recently, you're mentioning that is now, while it was quote piloted here, will be expanding throughout the state.
Yes. Yeah, it was, we looked to, make a few modifications to a typical recycling event. And in this case, we enlisted the support of the utilities and Mass Save and said, hey, look, we're going to do a recycling event where we're going to collect electronics and furniture. But why don't we have the folks from Mass Save come to the event so that they can talk to people about ways that they can save energy in their own homes. I don't know about you, but when I first heard about Mass Save probably, 10 years ago, I thought it was some sort of a scam. And I said, really, I'm going to have somebody come into my house and they're going to do an energy audit.
Yes.
What kind of a scam is that? Well, I reluctantly agreed to do it a couple of years ago. And it was one of the best things I did. They pointed out areas where I could do better venting to get circulation in my bathrooms, more insulation in my attic, and a number of other steps. And they offered rebates on highly efficient appliances. So we said, we need to, if we're going to get to net zero by 2050, let's get more people participating in this Mass Save program. Let's get more people thinking about recycling and getting higher efficiency. So we built this event up and said, hey, let's pilot it out in Franklin. And it was a highly successful event. We had hundreds of vehicles coming through. They were lined up. The event started at 9:00. They were lined up on Beaver Street at 8:30. So we opened the event even earlier. Right. We ended up gathering 4 truckloads of furniture, which go to Habitat for Humanity. And Habitat for Humanity has a store where they sell the furniture in order to raise money to do their home building projects.
Sure. Fund their other operations. Yep.
Exactly. We gathered 3 truckloads of electronics. We had a number of people who signed up for Mass Save at the event. And it turned out, and we also collected dehumidifiers.
Yeah.
And, anybody who brought a humidifier to the event that was in working condition got a $30 check from Mass Save. And if they went out and purchased a new dehumidifier that was Energy Star rated, they would get an additional $30 back in the form of a rebate. So $60 just for bringing your dehumidifier. We gathered in that 3-hour time period, 104 dehumidifiers that are no longer in circulation. And why is that important? That before this day, the program on an annual basis collected 1,600 dehumidifiers statewide. Okay. And in 1 3-hour time period,
you got 100.
We collected 104. So that was a signal to folks that, hey, if you do something differently, you may have better results. And so we did an event with all of the representatives and senators at the State House. It was on Zoom, but we invited teams from Mass Save and the Green Team Recovery Center and Habitat for Humanity to come in and talk about the services they could offer. We're even adding a mattress collection group to the mix, and showed them how we did the operation in Franklin and encouraged folks to sign up and do them in their own communities, because it was great to get the word out about recycling, great to introduce people to Mass Save, and great to get these products out of houses and into recycling centers. And we have had a sweep across the board. Representative Soder from Bellingham has done at least two events, one in Bellingham, one in Uxbridge, and they're taking off. We've got events scheduled throughout the rest of the year. We're now booking into 2022 across the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and we're going to smash that record of 1,600 dehumidifiers, and we're really going to get people being conversant in the language of recycling. So I'm very excited that that little pilot event that we started in Franklin that was tremendously successful is going to be replicated across the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Yeah. So for somebody who missed the one in Franklin and has electronics, whether humidifier or other, is there a schedule that we can share with the folks and so that they can tap into other events?
I would say I will get you a link to the Green Team Junk Removal site, and they're the major driver behind these events, and they will publish or they do publish their schedule of where they're going to be.
Where they're going to be.
And when. And I will tell you that my hope is to do this at least once, maybe twice a year in Franklin, and I think you'll see that across the Commonwealth.
Oh, that helps. And related to that, I've been hearing more about MassSave, particularly because, and I think it says in relation to the goals that you set and you touted earlier, one of the other initiatives on MassSave's plate is to, instead of, or in addition to doing the energy audit, also start providing to the homeowners, because there's also a push to switch from fossil fuel from a furnace and heating perspective to electric.
Yeah.
And that certainly I've got oil. I've had oil since that was the way the house was built. Now, how do we convert? who does that? And if MassSave can certainly help in that space, that'll certainly help the Commonwealth overall achieve some of those goals.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we did in the roadmap bill back in March was to require MassSave in their 3-year plans to consider the carbon footprint in how they were rolling out their plans. And so their 3-year plan is due to commence in January of 2022. So they had released the initial draft back in March or April. And then the roadmap bill passed.
Right.
And they had to revisit what they were going to do, because we were forcing them to accelerate the movement towards more renewable sources of energy. And I'm happy to say that I saw a draft of the new proposal that came out a couple of weeks ago, and they are going to do exactly what you said. They're going to provide much greater information on alternatives to folks who are looking to make that conversion. And I will say, you know, it's funny you talk about oil in your home. My brother-in-law, we were having dinner the other night, and he said, look, I'm in the process of replacing my system, and I heat my home on oil. What thoughts do you have? I said, well, my first thought is you should wait until January for the new rebates and new offerings to come out from MassSave.
Right.
So if you're not in an emergency situation, wait. But, you know, if you can, remove the oil tank from your home. And, you know, heat pumps are probably the latest rage. And he looks at me, goes, well, nobody knows anything about heat pumps. And how do I find an installer? I said, well, that's what we're working on to make that transition. I said, if you replace that oil heating system, you're only kicking the can down the road.
Right.
By 2050, that's going to have to be gone. And I know that's 29 years away, but, you know, why not take care of it now as opposed to waiting? So look for some major changes with MassSave starting in January.
Yeah, I'll be keeping my ears open on that one. I know we had them in for the energy audit several years ago, and in addition to the insulation, which we did, and some window sealing and all that stuff, et cetera. They also had a whole bunch of, the energy efficient lights and rebates for those, et cetera. So yeah, we're mostly LED lighted at this point. So yeah,
those are all things. They replace all the bulbs in your home at no charge to you.
Yeah.
And I say at no charge to you, you are actually paying for this service as a piece of your electric bill. And
in the details, in the fine details on the electrical bill, there's a small little charge that's in there.
So you've already paid for it.
Sure.
So why not take advantage of the program? You're going to save yourself some money, because I know once we did all these changes in my house, you know, my gas bill went down. And it was wild to see, you know, how a few changes in your house can make you far more efficient, save your money, and also save the environment at the same time. So it's a total win situation. So anybody who's hasn't done it, I urge you to do it. Now, you could do it, you know, every 3 years. So, you know, try it again.
I think I'll wait till the other, you know, heat pump stuff is available to do it. I feel comfortable at this point. That'll be the next step for sure.
We're looking to one of the other things that we put in the roadmap bill is to pilot the geothermal networks so that communities of homes could do geothermal technology to power more than one home. And that pilot program is underway. I've been trying to hook up with the folks at Eversource to go and actually view some of these sites where they're implementing geothermal. I don't think you want to wait for that, Steve.
No.
But, you know, that's probably a few years out that you'll see some neighborhoods shifting to geothermal technology, which is an amazing way to heat and cool your home.
Yeah, and tying back to my comments on Iceland, certainly there's realms within geothermal. So the geothermal piece that I was referring to, Iceland, you know, at least in the US, the fault lines are along the California coast. So we're not able to utilize those geyser and hot springs, et cetera, because they don't exist in New England. But to your point, there we can do the heat pumps, which is another form of that. And that is available. You just, the ground air, as you, anybody who's ever been in a cave, once you go down a certain number of feet, that temperature is there. And then it's that same temperature all the time.
Yep.
And then you just switch it. So in summertime, it's cooling, and in wintertime, it's heating. And indeed. So there's lots coming. And that's why we have these conversations, which kind of gives us a good segue into our next piece, because there are a number of conversations that across topics you're also involved in as a course of business. And I know you were on the agenda and dais, so to speak, stage actually at the Black Box for the recent Strong Towns event, which I found rather insightful.
That was a great conversation. So we brought out the author of the Strong Towns book, and he also has an extensive website where he talks about what we need to do to strengthen our communities, and is somewhat critical about the way that we have designed communities post-World War II, and is encouraging us to, you know, look inward again and see what we can do to redesign our communities to make them stronger. And walkability, I think, was one of the big themes of his talk, walkability, bikeability, and moving people around communities away from the notion that you have to have an automobile to get around. You know, design your community so that you don't need two or three cars per family. And, you know, it brought back memories to me of when we did the master plan the last time back in 2012 and 2013. I was on the town council, and a big part of that conversation was, you know, making central cores in the community and making that central core accessible through sidewalks and, you know, walking paths so that people could move around. And so it was nice to see that theme reaffirmed by the work that Chuck Mahone has been doing with the Strong Towns. And I think the best part about it was we got to see, and the stage was designed intentionally to have a local public official, Kobe Frangillo from the town council, and he's a Strong Towns member, me as a state official, and Congressman Auchincloss as a federal official, along with the author of the book, to have a conversation about how these three levels of government can and should work together with the goal of making our community strong. And it was nice to see, you know, local and state officials from throughout Congressman Auchincloss's district. I mean, we had folks from Brookline and Newton and Seekonk and all over the 4th Congressional District who came to Franklin to engage in a conversation. And I found it enlightening and hope it's the first of many that we can communicate with each other and determine best practices and really enhance our communities across the Commonwealth.
Yeah, it's a path. It's a way forward. And the conversations, it brings to mind a African proverb I picked up recently that certainly plays into this, is if you want to go quickly somewhere, you go alone. If you want to go there and be able to truly sustain that trip, go with somebody.
Yeah.
And in order to go with somebody, you have to have the conversation to make sure, okay, this is the right path. How are we going to do this? And making that change, if there is a change, and what is the nature of the change and what's the impact, that's going to take time. It's going to take conversations. And certainly in my role, that's I facilitate those, I'll help to facilitate those conversations and surely share that info. So yeah, it's near and dear. And it's just one of the topics that are on our space. And I know the other one from a mental health and substance use, you had a quote, critical conversation. I was a little disappointed in the overall turnout, but it was still a start. We don't expect everything to happen at once. And yeah, that was a good event last Thursday.
Well, you know, one thing that I observed while I was there, I mean, there were probably 40 people in the audience, but there were about 70 people who were participating online. 70 yes. people that had dialed in.
Correct.
That could be groups of people sitting in their homes. So initially, I was a little disappointed to look into the crowd and see that, you know, there weren't a lot of folks there. But it was nice to see that folks were paying attention at home. Mental health and substance abuse are really closely interconnected. And one thing we have seen during the pandemic is the number of mental health issues has increased. Substance abuse has increased. And I think one of the comments I made at the event was that we've seen a 31% uptake in opioid abuse, you know, nationwide. But in Franklin and Massachusetts, the number in terms of increases was in the single digits. I'm not saying that's good news because that's still an indication that we have a problem, but it's also an indication that given the steps that we've taken as a state and a local community and in our regional coalition, it's having an impact in that there more people are able to get onto the pathway to recovery. And the intent of that event was to let people know that they're not alone in having a child facing either a mental health or a substance use issue or both, and that there are some tremendous resources available in the community. And if you get the help that you or your children need, you can, you know, you can straighten the path and get them on a pathway to recovery. So you saw a panel of police officers, school officials, officials from the SAFE Coalition. I was there offering the state perspective. And there was even a young man who suffered substance use disorder himself, talking about his story. So it was an engaging conversation, and one of what I expect will be a number of critical conversations that we'll have over the course of the next couple of years as we emerge from this pandemic. I think the pandemic showed that we have a lot of gaps that we need to fill, and it brought to the top, you know, some issues that we need to face in both the mental health and substance use space. But and we continue to learn from these. And another piece that I had described at the meeting itself was the notion of making mental health true parity with other the treatment of other medical conditions. And the day before that event, the Senate had passed a mental health parity bill that would require insurance companies to offer free annual mental health checkups to patients, mm-hmm. just like you go to your primary care physician for an annual physical.
Sure.
You can go and get a mental health checkup. So that was a positive piece of legislation directed towards, you know, mental health treatment and making it on par with other health conditions. So we're moving in the right direction. And I fully expect that that conversation will be on the floor of the House of Representatives within the next couple of months.
And I think the key piece there as well, in 2 points of reflections, I was at one of the early meetings of what became the SAFE Coalition, what, 5.5, 6 years ago?
2015.
Yep. Also at the high school. And that was at that time very well attended. I think there were about 300 at that meeting at that time because the need was there. I think to the point that they have over their 5.5, 6 years developed so many programs. People are indeed being served. We're not done yet by any means. And even in the words of the recovering addict whose name escapes me at the moment, but he's 30 something months sober and every day is a challenge. Right? Yeah. So the support is there, but he's not done yet. And what has happened and needs to continue to happen is just make that awareness of the support to that new brand line. You know, you're not alone. Nope. Feel free, reach out, call the number. We'll include the SAFE hotline number, which is available 24/7. So you at least can start that conversation to get on the road.
I mean, that's that organization has been incredible. You know, I met Jen back in late 2014 with this idea that she just wanted to start a small group discussion that people could come together and talk about substance use issues. But in working with her, learning that, you know, this was a much bigger problem and needed much bigger resources. And I met Jim Derrick at that first event that we had on June 30th of 2015, mm-hmm. where the 300 people showed up, and Jim hopped up on the stage as soon as the event was over. And he said, "I'm in, I want to do something." Between Jim and Jen, they have built a powerful organization that has changed the whole dynamic of substance use treatment in our area and opened up avenues of recovery that we could only dream about back then. And I'm so honored to have crossed paths with both of them and watched this organization build into a great resource for the community. And I was thrilled that the town council last week is investing $175,000 into this organization. Mm-hmm. Because they see the power of the work that the SAFE Coalition has done and know that it provides a future for so many. And I couldn't be any more proud to know Jim and Jen and work with them continuing to this day. I still remain on the board of directors of that organization, and I don't know that I'll ever leave, because it's the work is too crucial to the community.
It's saving lives. I remember the August event, the National Overdose Day. It was, what, 2,100 flags we set out, purple flags, to recognize how many people had passed in the prior year.
Yeah,
we're still on path. I think, based on the numbers I saw at the three-quarter mark, we're close to that. So, yeah, in terms of the local approach, we're at least lessening the curve, as opposed to other parts in the state, in the nation, rather, that are unfortunately seeing and not having these resources or seeing the worsening effects. But yeah, our work is not done.
No,
not at all. And related to that, but more into back kind of full circle into the government aspect, in terms of continuing to foster changes in the government and recognition that it takes time. We have to have conversations in order to move legislation, whether it's genocide legislation, whether it's to foster mass save and energy changes. All of that takes time. All of that takes a conversation. And I think you and I were fortunate to have, well, you specifically were part of a conversation with the More Perfect Union group with Danielle Allen, who then got recognized by the Library of Congress with an award last week. And some of her remarks, I think, tie nicely into some of the things that, you know, are on our radar in terms of fostering these civil and civic conversations.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, we've seen a sea shift in methods of communication with the advent of the internet, which, you know, really began in the 90s and has developed into the main source of information for people. You know, as I was growing up in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s, you got your information from a daily newspaper, which was robust and was thick and was fact-checked and was presented to you in an objective format. Mm-hmm. You know, you always hear that, you know, certain newspapers lean in a certain direction. Yeah, okay, but it's more balanced information, and the TV news was a lot more balanced back in those days. But once the proliferation of the internet place, it became the Wild West for information. And you know, as companies like Facebook got into the business, and as people began to turn away from newspapers as their source of information, I think we saw a great shift in the conversation. And, you know, the recent reports that we've heard about Facebook in their model and their algorithms being based on generating hatred in order to generate readership, in order to, you know, promote their business. Their business is based on selling ads. And so the more people that they can get spending time on Facebook and other social media pieces, the more money they make. And it's based on hatred for one another. And that does not lead to civil discourse. So, Steve, we could do a whole show on this very topic.
Being mindful of time, we probably will have to do another whole show on that, for sure.
Yeah. You know, and now you see that, you know, as Facebook has been caught in some horrific conduct, mm-hmm. You know, they're not really doing a mea culpa, and you know, they are taking some corrective measures, but appallingly, they changed the name of their company to Meta, and they're moving into the virtual reality space, where they will create communities where people can get together in virtual reality settings, which just takes away from civil discourse. You know, there's nothing like sitting at a table with a group of people, looking each other in the eye and watching each other's body language and and picking up the social cues that you can't do in a social media environment. We need to revisit how we communicate with one another so that we can, save our society. And I'll leave it at that because, again, that's a whole show. And in fact, last week, Speaker DeLeo teaches at Northeastern University, and he said, "Do you think you would be willing to come in and talk to my class about the role of Facebook and social media and how that has changed the way we look at things and how we can, look at it from a government perspective?" And I was happy to do it. And it was a 2-hour class, and the exchange was incredible. And, I think my message to the folks in the class was, we can't succeed by demonizing one another.
No.
And that's really the goal of these social media platforms, is to develop levels of resentment. And that's not how we're going to reach commonality. We're much better when we work together and teams come together with different perspectives and different outlooks, but take the best of those conversations and move in a direction together. People brought together and unified by a single mission can change the world. And we have to get back to that way of thinking. And I'm hoping that these types of conversations will actually lead to that. So let's try not to demonize.
No, to that end, I'll put a quick reminder and plug that Franklin Matters will be leaving Facebook at the end of the month. To that point, I tried doing it several years ago. Respectfully, the people there said, "Hey, no. And I conceded. This time, certainly based upon the whistleblowers' complaints and the multiple documentation and analysis around that, MIT's coming out. I think Gizmodo is actually preparing all the docs that were released as part of the whistleblower complaint for public consumption. So that entire treasure trove of all the data, and the data is memos within Facebook, studies within Facebook, proving too that, oh, if we do this and people like hate more, then we boost it. I'm sorry, I just cannot contribute to that environment anymore. So November 30th will be the last day of Franklin Matters on Facebook, which is to say Franklin Matters does not go away. Franklin still matters, but there was life before Facebook. There will be life after Facebook. It just won't be on Facebook.
You'll probably feel better.
I hope so. And I'm sure there's still going to be, due to the nature of the feed, I've got over 5,000 people who follow. Yep. There hasn't been a sufficient uptick in the other places for people to subscribe. So at some point in time, beginning November 30th, people are going to realize, oh, where is he? Where is this info? And I'm sure there'll be an uproar, but that's part of the game that Facebook is forcing us to play. I've tried within the game without spending money, because that's one of the things that they want. They want me to boost the post. And who gains? They do. I'm doing this for free. I don't have that kind of money. So enough of a rant on my side. We'll continue this conversation, because I think this is something that it would be worthwhile to do.
Yep, I look forward to it. Thank you.
And in the meantime, thank you for taking time today to share what's going on, and certainly have a good Thanksgiving for you and your family and friends. And I wish all the listeners as well have a good Thanksgiving as well.
And you as well. Thank you so much for what you do.
Thank you. I do this because Franklin Matters.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.